than any other person, Israel is fascinated by David, deeply attracted to him, bewildered by him, occasionally embarrassed by him, but never disowning him. David is one of those extraordinary historical figures who has a literary future. That is, his memory and presence keep generating more and more stories. One must, of course, recognize that others formulated those stories, perhaps even fabricated parts of them. But surely there can be no doubt that it is David's magnificent and mysterious person that generated them. Perhaps because Israel could never quite get it right. None of the stories could quite take in all of him. He's a person who fits David Tracy's notion of a classic. People keep coming back to him for authority, not doubting that there is more yet to be given in the stories about him. We've tried to look this week, if you've been able to come to more than just today's session, but you'll understand today's session even if you weren't here all this week, don't worry. We've tried to look this week at the sweep of David's story, how he started as an outsider and with the support of all the other outsiders, in other words, with all of Israel, who felt themselves to be marginalized people who had no secure place in the land they were living in. They were threatened both by the Canaanites, who occupied the best farming territory, and by people like the Philistines, who had a military establishment that tried to run them out of the what marginal hill country they did have. David, working with them and representing them, comes to a place of security and safety and rest and even of power. When David gets this kind of power in his hands, then, the story subtly changes and it's no longer a, rah, rah, we're with David, he's our kind of guy and he's doing for us what we need to have done. It's suddenly a story where we begin to see the depths and the hard questions at work. What do you do when you have power? What are your obligations and responsibility if God has given you rest from your enemies and resources to live with? For whose good shall these things be used? How do the choices we make to keep or not keep God's covenant continue to spin themselves out in our lives? What are the consequences of sin? What are the consequences of being God's chosen person or people? And we have a rather extended passage today, the story about David and his interaction with his son Absalom, which continues to look at some of those questions. The more I read this story again, getting ready for today, the more I think that the verdict on David and his reign is very mixed. I think what Brueggemann said about David is certainly true to the point that he's at the cusp of his power. And then after that, we just see one story after another where David's choice to use the power God had given him to violate his proper relationship with his people and with God, which he showed by breaking many of the commandments, taking Uriah's wife for himself and killing Uriah and lying about what he was trying to do and trying to cover it up, and not recognizing that by doing that he was putting himself in God's shoes and saying, God has given me this power for me and I can use it any way I want. That the results of that unfaithfulness on David's part, even though it didn't mean that God abandoned him, because God had made a promise that no matter what David or his sons would do, God's love and support would be there. God wouldn't break the covenant. Even so, the human consequences pollute the rest of David's history. And it's a very mixed story. In other words, it's a very human story. There's no romanticism about this. After that point of great power, when David abuses his power, then David's not the glorious shining hero who can make no mistakes anymore. He's presented to us as someone whose leadership is quite ambiguous, not entirely successful. And today he faces a challenge from his son Absalom. The challenge comes at many different points. It's of David's own style of leadership. It's a challenge that comes up because of David's increasing age and being part of the old establishment instead of the new guard. It's a challenge of of the results of David's own choices. Here's a Philip Culbertson, this book right here, The New Adam, comments about the stories about David and Absalom. Throughout these stories, there is no mention of Absalom's mother, only of the maternal grandfather and various other males of the story. This is not a multidimensional story about men and women. Rather, it is a skillfully told story about the dysfunctional relationship between a father and a son, brought about by the father's emotional distance from his own children. It's a man's story about men, for other than Tamar and the seer of Tekoa, two women we'll see as we go along, there are no women in this extended portion of the David cycle. It's a story about what happens when a father is busy exercising power, when he becomes a caricature of success to his children, and when he protects a man's prerogative for traditional male roles, even at the expense of his family. And so we'll look at quite a few chapters today. I will talk us through them. We'll be doing less reading and more description of sections as we go along. Let's go to 2 Samuel 13. Second Samuel 13 to 14 is a story that can stand by itself as a drama, and yet it also functions as the stage for Absalom to emerge as a central character in the next few chapters. Verses 1 to 6 in 2 Samuel 13 set the scene for the drama to follow. Now, Absalom, David's son, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And after a time, Amnon, David's son, loved her. Now, notice how these people are described here. Absalom, David's son, has a sister. His relationship to Tamar is given, but she is not called David's daughter, which she was, and in fact, David's going to be no help to her in story. Absalom is going to be a help to her, and so there's something already indicative about calling her Absalom's sister. But notice the other person involved, Amnon, David's son, his relationship to his sister is not given. And in fact, he's going to take no regard for his relationship with his sister. That's not something that's important to him except when it's convenient to him. So what happens here is that, let me just also comment, Amnon is the firstborn of David, the one most likely to be the next king. Absalom is younger, not in line for the throne. Tamar's in between. Absalom is the third child. So both, if you want to look at it that way, both Tamar and Absalom share something. They're both beautiful. We hear that about Absalom later. He had, among other things, a fine head of hair that he cut once a year because it got so heavy and bothersome to him. And they both can't inherit. Tamar because she's a woman, and Absalom because he's not the firstborn. But even more important than that, Absalom becomes Tamar's defender here. Well, what happens is that Amnon decides that he wants to sleep with his sister, but of course he doesn't think of her as his sister. He thinks of her as my brother Absalom's sister. Notice that in verse 4. Yeah, they could have been half. They were all half brother and sister. And I don't remember, haven't sorted out exactly whose mother is what. But there is still this kind of distancing and impersonalization by how you choose. I've done that. Sometimes, you know, when I'm talking about my children, suddenly I will say to their father, your children, you won't believe what your children did today. That's right. That's right. And that same kind of thing is going on here, and you can tell sometimes why someone is called one thing and not another. There's another person who gets involved in this. His name is Jonadab. He's a cousin of all of them. But he allies himself with Amnon and comes up with a daring scheme, a way that Amnon can get his sister alone and vulnerable. Notice Jonadab involves the king. The king is made the go-between, and he's not called David right there says, get the king to do this. When the king comes, Amnon says to the king. So David is already somewhat distanced. And David does it. It's really ironic because what he's doing, what David is doing by being the go-between, Amnon's pretending he's sick. David is going to send Tamar to take care of Amnon to nurse him back to health. David is becoming the go-between the way that he sent a messenger to bring Bathsheba back to him. David is functioning in that role now to permit, to set up the situation where sexual violence can happen. And so David is participating in a rerun of his own story in a slightly new role this time, but it's the same awful pattern that's continuing throughout the family. Jonadab's scheme works, verses 7 to 22. Tamar is raped. She says no before it happens. She says no to it after it happens. She shows publicly her grief and distress by changing the style of her clothing even as she leaves the room so that people will know that she's no longer an unmarried virgin woman in Israel. And in the response to the crime, Absalom emerges as the central character of the story, Tamar's vindicator. Look at what Absalom says to her, verse 20. And following. This is capable of a couple different interpretations. Her brother Absalom said to her, has Amnon, your brother, been with you? Already indicating it's an illicit relationship. He's your brother, he's not your husband. Technically, and Tamar knows this, she suggested it to Amnon, David could have arranged for her to be given in marriage to her half-brother. And then the relationship would have been legal, and then she wouldn't have been shamed by it, and neither would Amnon as a lawbreaker. So it's not so much that it's her brother as that it's her brother, not her husband. And so Absalom says to Tamar, now hold your peace, my sister. He is your brother, not your husband. But don't take this to heart. So you can read this as if Absalom is very callous and he's saying, oh, come on, you know, big deal, happens all the time. But it's also possible to read this as he knows that this is a crime because Amnon is her brother, not her husband, and that it wasn't appropriate, it was illegal, it was also an act of violence. And he's saying it's going to take a while to work this out, but we'll work this out. And I think that's what he's saying because verse 23, after 2 full years, things have worked out to the point where Absalom can take revenge on Amnon for the fact that he forced their sister Tamar. But before we get there, let's go back to verse 21. When King David heard of all these things, he was very angry. Well, why was King David, not Father David, King? Why was King David angry about all this? Embarrassed by it, sure. He's supposed to have, he's supposed to be able to take his family out for photo opportunities for the press. He's not supposed to have to account for why Tamar is living desolately in her brother Absalom's house and how this violence happened in his own home. But quite revealingly, David doesn't do anything. He feels angry, but he doesn't talk to anybody about it. He doesn't say, this has got to stop. He doesn't say, Amnon, you've got to repent. And in fact, there are other manuscripts where it says simply, David did not rebuke Amnon, for Amnon was the firstborn son. We kind of wonder how David found out. Did Tamar tell him? Or if Absalom, I don't suppose Amnon told him, I don't think, or Jonadab. If Absalom told him, and those other manuscripts are correct, maybe Absalom, being kind of young and naive, was appealing to his father for justice, and instead he found that his father is the king, who's going to defend the male prerogative to abuse women, even within their own family. The distant father, the powerful king, the defender of the rights of men to use women. This shows Absalom some kind of hollow authority on David's part. He has an authority that's full of power, but not of moral authority. And so Absalom already finds disappointment in his father and has to take justice in his own hands. So 2 years later, verses 23 to 33, the time for revenge comes. Absalom proposes that the king and everybody go to sheep shearing, which is a big party. It's a big time. They take the wool off the sheep and they party the whole time. In the end, David doesn't go. Only the princes go. Absalom tries to use David as part of the plot to take revenge, but David isn't called by name in this part here. He's not even called Absalom's father. He's just called the king. By now, the king is so distanced from his son by his refusal to effect justice for a despicable crime in their family that he's just a shell. He's an office. He's not a person. So the princes all go sheep shearing with all of their retinue, and Absalom's deeply loyal servants carry out his instructions to kill Amnon when he's drunk. It's kind of like, it's reminiscent of when David set up Uriah, got him drunk. It's also reminiscent of how David's loyal servants would do whatever he would bid them. Now, Absalom has the same kind of power over his servants, the same kind of loyalty from his servants. Notice that Absalom has an ulterior motive. If Amnon is killed, then Absalom is next in line for the throne. And yet the story isn't put in terms of this motive, but in terms of he hated his brother because he forced their sister. Well, the word gets back to David in the confusion that breaks out after Amnon's assassination that all of his sons are dead. And oddly enough, David is ready to believe it. He knew that his family was troubled, but maybe he didn't know how much. But it turns out that only one of the king's sons, only Amnon, is dead. And David grieves. It may be that he understands why Absalom did it, taking an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. It was, in a sense, even revenge. But still, David mourns. Notice verse 37. And yeah, we'll get to 39. But 37 right now, Absalom fled and went to his grandfather, and David mourned for his son day after day. Which son is he mourning for? Amnon or Absalom. Could be either one. My reading of it is that he's mourning for Amnon because for 3 years he mourns this son very bitterly. 3 years, the usual period of mourning is 1 year. Absalom has been so mistrustful of his father, he wasn't sure how this assassination would sit with him, if he would understand or if he would punish. And so Absalom fled. And in those 3 years of grieving, Absalom too is gone, but his father, by my reading of it, doesn't even think of him until the 3 years are over, and he suddenly says, you know, well, I'm done mourning for Amnon. Oh yeah, Absalom, where is he now? And so then the spirit of the king longed to go forth to Absalom, for he'd reached the point of comfort about Amnon, seeing he was dead. So these are 3 long years for Absalom, coming to 5 years altogether since the time of the rape of Tamar, when he's longed for something different from his father. And when the time comes that finally David's mind turns to Absalom, David is in a position of pride and stubbornness. He wouldn't know how to reach out to his son who's so far away. Fortunately, David has this closest business associate, this hatchet man, Joab, who has not hesitated to do dirty deeds for him before and understands the mind of his master. And Joab knows that David is longing for Absalom. And so, next chapter 14, Joab sets up, perceiving David's need, sets up a clever plan to permit this proud and stubborn king to do what he really, really wants deep down and is too proud to do. Joab sends in a woman of the town of Tekoa to do a kind of theater with David. This woman is standing in the place of Nathan in the other story. Nathan told a parable that got the truth through to the king about the grievous nature of his sin with Uriah and Bathsheba. And here the woman does the same thing. She tells David this story. She engages him in conversation for a long time. They go back and forth, but basically her plot is, look, I have two sons. One of them killed the other one. Now the rest of my family says, we've got to kill the one who killed the one that's dead, or banish him at least, send him away. And she says, I don't see it that way because he's my only remaining son, my only source of support. He's my son. I love him. I don't think he should be killed. She's modeling to David a different alternative. David the king thinks in terms of revenge and attack and counterattack and counterattack and counterattack, kind of in a never-ending, you go back and forth until somebody is militarily superior or somebody is just too weak and exhausted to respond or whatever. She has another version. She says true virtue wouldn't be keeping a grudge. True virtue would be forgiving the sinner and welcoming them home. She's kind of a forerunner of the waiting father in the parable that Luke tells. She says, somebody goes to a far country, you know, you don't say you deserve what you got because you were in the far country. You say, you would welcome home, and you call them home if you have the power to do that. And David is convinced. He also recognizes Joab's hand behind this, but he's willing to live with that too. So in verses 21 to 24, he sends Joab out to bring Absalom home. And then suffers a change in his mind right at the last minute. Verse 24, the king said, but let him dwell apart in his own house. He's not to come in my presence. So David makes a move towards reconciliation, but he can't bring himself to go through with it for whatever reason. And it's an impossible holding pattern for Absalom. He's home, but he's not home. He's received by David, but he's not received by David. The king has brought him home, but the father has not welcomed the son. We have a little interlude in verses 25 to 27 about Absalom's looks and power and popularity. Time passes, and then it's 2 years later. Now it's 7 years after the rape of Tamar. When Absalom can't stand living this way in Jerusalem any longer, verses 28 to 33, he tries to get Joab's attention. He knows that Joab has the king's ear, even though he, Absalom the son, does not have his father David's ear. And so Absalom tries to call Joab in twice, and it doesn't work. Joab only responds to his master. And then Absalom sets fire to Joab's field. That gets Joab's attention. Joab comes in and says, what were you doing? And Absalom says, well, I was trying to get your attention. I want to see David. You know, I want to see my father. Actually, he says, I want to see the king. I, you know, I'm willing to take what he's going to give me. If he's going to kill me, fine. If he's going to receive me, fine. Well, Joab went to the king and told him, verse 33, and he summoned Absalom. So Absalom came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king. And the king kissed Absalom. Hard to tell if this is a reconciliation or not, because it's not presented to us as a son being kissed by his father. Mm-hmm. Instead, an occupation kisses a person. Maybe David was doing it to please Joab. Maybe David the king thought it was publicly appropriate, but his heart was not reconciled to his son and what he had done. And the son, Absalom, for his part, swallowing his pride, finds that his father is distant. The opportunity to be simply David and Absalom, father and son, presents itself, but David's emotionally bankrupt. He has no identity in this text except his professional role. You can't help but wonder if he could have done something different at this point, if the tragic ending of the story could have been averted. And the fact that Absalom does not feel it as a welcoming home and a reconciliation seems to me to be clear in chapter 15 through 19. Because what happens now is the rebellion of Absalom in roughly three broad movements. Absalom stages a coup, and David has to leave Jerusalem, his city of his royal city. They have all sorts of conflicts and competing strategies. But finally, David wins, if you could call it a victory, and Absalom is killed. It's a loosely related series of stories, but it all flows down in this direction. A terrible drama of ruthless power and ambivalent love, one author says. The speeches are more important than the actions. We've seen that before in these books. They tell a lot about what's going on. Sometimes the important events are compressed into just a couple little verses after a lot of conversation has gone on beforehand. So, how am I doing? In chapter 15 to 16, the coup and David's flight, I'll talk us through these things. 15 verse 1 to 6, we want to look at this kind of closely. Let's read that verse by verse.
Which one?
Chapter 15, verses 1 to 6. Anyone could start.
After this, Absalom got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way of the gate. And when any man had a suit to come before the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "From what city are you?" And when he said, "Your servant is of such and such a tribe in Israel," Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but there is no man deputed by the king to hear you." Absalom said, "Moreover, oh, that I were judging in the land. Then every man with a suit or cause might come to me, and I would give him justice. And whenever a man came near to do obedience to him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him." Thus Absalom did to all of Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel.
Power vacuum in Israel. One of David's jobs is to administer justice, and the place people would come would be to the gate, and they were supposed to find a judge there, justice of the peace, ready to hear their story and to help them solve it. Nobody even there. I mean, what's David doing with his time and his energy and his power? It's kind of like he's just really a hollow shell, not only of a man, but also of a king. And so Absalom sets himself up as the candidate for king, even though there still is someone. There's no vacancy in the office at the moment.
Well, don't you think, too, it's because his father, the king, would not see him,
yeah,
and would not forgive him?
Yeah. Yeah, that's how I read it. In a way, there's no justice between him and David, and so he's going
to
be the expert in justice and try to set it up for everyone else's. Yeah. And what happens is Israel loves him the way they had loved David before. And so 4 years later, verses 7 to 12, Absalom performs his coup and declares that he is now king at Hebron, which was the first place that David had been publicly acclaimed as king in Israel. Absalom covers up this move by saying he's going out to Hebron to worship. That's something that's been used in the story of David before. Samuel covered up why he was going to Bethlehem to find David and anoint him by saying he was going down there to make a sacrifice. So worship is once again a cover for political activity. Notice in verse 12 the word conspiracy is used to remind us that the story is told from the point of view of David, who is ostensibly the winner. But it would have been possible, especially if the story had gone otherwise, to throw your support on the side of Absalom. In fact, there was a lot of popular support for Absalom, enough that he can here have a claim to be king, and David takes it seriously. And it's just a real interesting irony that David is now presented as the old establishment figure who's somehow ineffectual and so caught up in bureaucracy or in not being there or in whatever it is. And the vigor is allied with Absalom, the one who is beautiful, the one who is strong, the one who is loved. He's mirroring his father's attributes that his father had had in his younger years. Chapter 15, verses 13 to 31. David gets the news. He understands the people are with Absalom. The only people with David seem to be at this point the people in the palace with him and his hired guard, verse 16. The voluntary support goes with Absalom. The paid support goes with David. And David, in a long, drawn-out royal process, leaves Jerusalem to go to the wilderness where he can be more elusive and not quite such a sitting duck sort of target. It's not a hasty flight. He takes his time and he makes some important strategic moves as he leaves. And in the strategic moves, he, readers of the story, begin to wonder if Absalom has assessed his father correctly or not, because David makes very shrewd moves, militarily and in terms of military intelligence, that are going to help him out in the long run. We'll look at those briefly. First of all, verses 19 to 23, a foreigner comes along and David appoints him as one of his three commanders. If he has to appoint a foreigner as a commander, that says something again about the lack of popular support for David. His two priests in verses 24 to 29 want to come with him, bringing the sign of God's presence and success with the ark. But David says to them, knowing the wilderness, soldiers will be more important to him than priests. He says, you stay in Jerusalem. And then he also says in verse 28, you be my eyes and ears. You're going to be my spies. He also, in verses 25 to 26, casts himself on God's favor. This is not the bold, confident David of before. But it is still David who in hard times trusts God. And right here he says, 25 to 26, if I find favor in the eyes of the Lord will bring me back and let me see both Jerusalem and the ark. But if the Lord says, I have no pleasure in you, behold, here I am. Let him do to me what seems good to him. David is leaving town with ritual grief, verses 30 to 31. This is a publicly sad occasion, and they should be mourning as the king in humiliation is leaving his city. But notice he's also available to receive news briefs and intelligence information. He finds out that one of his high officials, one of his cabinet members, Ahithophel, has defected to the other side and is now giving advice to Absalom. And David's response to that is to pray, may Ahithophel's advice be foolishness. I mean, David, if he were on a basketball team, would not be praying for a good game. He would be praying for his team to win. And then verses 32 to 37, another high official, his name is Hushai, he's an official who's on the same par as Ahithophel, comes to David and says, I'm loyal to you. David sends him to be a plant in Absalom's high council. He's going to be an infiltrator. And he's also supposed to keep in touch with those two priests who are staying in Jerusalem, who are going to feed information to David. And so as he leaves town, David meets those who are loyal to him, and he deploys them in various ways that they'll be most useful for him, to outflank Absalom in military strategy and in intelligence information. Chapter 16, still going farther away from Jerusalem, he meets Ziba, who had been Saul's servant. Now, Saul's party, who was mad all along, I mean, all the people who had supported Saul, they were mad all along that David came and replaced Saul and that none of Saul's sons ever got to be on the throne. This looks to them like their chance. They're starting to come out of the woodwork and say, hey, we're going to support Absalom because if Absalom can overthrow David, then it's going to be a whole situation of upset. Maybe we can get one of Saul's remaining relatives back on the throne, somebody we like, someone who will see it our way. But Ziba, who had worked for Saul, comes along. He's got provisions for David, so God supplies for David's army in unexpected ways. And what Ziba is saying is, hey, I'm not loyal to Saul's party. I'm going to remain loyal to you. Now, Mephibosheth, Jonathan's son, Saul's grandson, he has turned coat, and he's gone against you, David. David, hearing this, just believes it. He doesn't even check it out, and he takes away from Mephibosheth the promise that he's given out of faithfulness to his covenant with Jonathan. He says, okay, Ziba, you servant, you've got all the land now. Mephibosheth has nothing. And then a little farther out, he meets another one from Saul's party, Shimei. Shimei actually curses David. Chapter 16, verse 7. Begone, begone, you man of blood, you worthless fellow. The Lord has avenged upon you all the blood of the house of Saul. See, this vengeance theme is maybe the key theme through all these things. Who is getting vengeance on whom for what? In whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. He's already predicting defeat for David. See, your ruin is on you, for you are a man of blood. And blood leads to blood. Well, somebody, a loyalist who's with David says, we're going to kill this guy Shimei. He's speaking blasphemy against the king. But, you know, that's all David needs. He's got to deal with Absalom. He doesn't need the whole party of supporters of Saul angry at him, too, for killing one of their men. So he just says in another kind of, you know, focus on what's important. He says, it may be the Lord has told him to curse me. It's kind of like he's admitting that all this is true and that this is on him because of how he's lived and behaved in the past. Verse 12, it may be that the Lord will look upon my affliction and that the Lord will repay me with good for this cursing of today. So there's something else David is willing to leave. In the midst of danger, he relies on God's grace. And he arrives at the Jordan River, which is the very edge of the territory that he administers. If he went any farther, he'd be in enemy hands himself. Of course, he's in enemy hands right there as it is. All right, chapter 16 to 18, we see David and Absalom with competing strategies. Absalom, while David's moving out to the margins in the wilderness, Absalom is moving into Jerusalem. He occupies his father's palace. Right away when he gets in town, Hushai, this high official of David's that David has sent to be an infiltrator, greets him and says, long live the king. But which king is Hushai talking about? Absalom, of course, wants to hear it, that Hushai is saying, long live King Absalom. He tests him a little bit, but he finally concludes, after Hushai comes up with more doublespeak like that, he finally concludes, and Hushai finally lies, and he says, look, I'm going to serve you the way I served your father. Absalom accepts him. Well, now, Ahithophel, whose advice has been like the advice of God, he's always been right about things, and he's the one who's defected to Absalom's side. He says, now that you're here in Jerusalem, make this really a public coup and show that your father is nothing. Take his property. Have sex with his concubines in public so that people know you are now in charge of his house. And thus the curse that God pronounced through Nathan, a sword will never depart from your house. We're seeing that happening in all these chapters. But Nathan had also said, God had also said, what you did secretly and tried to cover up, breaking the commandment and murdering and all the other things, with Uriah and Uriah's wife, will happen in broad daylight among your descendants. Well, here it is. David doesn't even have to watch it from heaven. He's got to right here in front of him. And then Ahithophel has more advice. The next thing that happens is a war council, a strategy meeting. What are we going to do now to get rid of David? Oh, I want to say something about Absalom taking David's concubines this way. Remember that Absalom used to be the protector of his raped sister, the sensitive son, the one who was against this kind of violence toward women. And now, in his bitterness, he's adopted the same traditional insensitivity and violence toward women that were the cause of his estrangement from his father in the first place, and that, moreover, was the cause of David's bringing this kind of violence into the family in the first place. And so Absalom has not escaped this cycle of abuse of power and of abuse of other people for his own ends. Absalom is a perpetrator and a victim, as much as David was. All right, well then, this is really interesting stuff how this works out. I'll try to do it quickly, but there's so many interesting passages along the way that you kind of like to stop and say, look at this, look at this. Absalom's side is having a strategy meeting. Ahithophel's advice is a quick strike to kill the king. Don't take any time. I myself will go in and do it. And it'll be over like that, and you'll be, your way to the throne will be cleared.
Which one said that?
Ahithophel. Oh. Hushai's advice is, well, that's not a good plan. The reason he gives is that David is such a famous warrior that he's not going to be vulnerable. So Hushai's advice is, take time, build an army, go after David and all his forces with his huge army. And Walter Brueggemann comments this way. The contrast could not be more clear. The simple, quick plan of Ahithophel versus the slow, grandiose strategy of Hushai. Common sense would dictate embracing the former. We've learned recently ourselves, however, that grand strategies like mining harbors, fencing whole countries, and defoliating whole forests have a certain mesmerizing attraction in wartime. It's possible for otherwise sober people to embrace war strategies that are as remote from reality as the plan of Hushai. Our own history tells us that war councils are not simply forums of reason, but struggles between massive egos, partisan interests, and much fantasy. So it is here. And the choice is made for Hushai's advice. Why? Because God has commanded it. It was what David prayed for. Let Ahithophel's advice seem to be foolishness. And so there's some comment in here about how God accomplishes God's purposes for the chosen one in, with, and under the earnest conversation and serious choices of people. God doesn't break in with a lightning bolt and do something. But it's also not just these guys sitting around having a conversation about the war. Somehow God is working in there that God's chosen one will be protected, so that we might reflect on the nature of the historical process and how God throws God's weight behind one thing or behind another thing. And as Martin Luther King Jr. liked to say, the moral arc of the universe tilts in God's direction, even if it might take a long time. The result of Ahithophel being shamed and not agreed with is that he goes off and commits suicide. We're down to verses 15 to 23. Hushai reports the results to the two priests in town who pass the word on to David, just as planned. The curious thing about it is the plan that they tell David about is the one that wasn't adopted, the one that was supposed to be a quick strike. So David begins to mobilize his forces as if he's in immediate jeopardy, when in fact Absalom has chosen the strategy of moving more slowly. But that's still to David's advantage. That's no skin off his back to respond to the other plan. So we get to the actual confrontation. We get ready for the actual confrontation at the end of chapter 17. We see Absalom's troop led by one leader, David's troops, in another gesture of public support, David's troops led by three leaders. He apparently has a lot of forces. He apparently has been mis- or underestimated by his son. And then at the beginning of chapter 18, David is successful. It's a great slaughter. David's own role in verses 3 to 4 is to stay behind, like Jean-Luc Picard in Star Trek. You know, he's too valuable to be put in the front lines. He sends the away teams to do the dirty work while he stays back and does strategy. David makes one order that we are all permitted to overhear. This is chapter 18, verse 5. Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. Deal gently. For my sake, he says, not for his sake. He says, with the young man Absalom. He doesn't say with my son. But somehow in a guarded and hidden way, he says what he wants to say, even if he doesn't give all the reasons that he wants to say it for. The battle, that's like I said, there it is, just like the killing of Goliath, preceded by 40 verses, happens in 2 verses, preceded by, you know, so many chapters. The battle itself is here in 2 verses, 6 to 8, and it's really a slaughter. And the forest devoured more people that day than the sword, which is foreshadowing for what will happen to Absalom. And so we move to the victory of David and the defeat of Absalom. Verse 9, Absalom gets caught in the tree and is hung there between heaven and earth. It's an unusual phrase, and it just kind of brings our attention to this here. He doesn't die right away. He's just entangled. He's trapped. Well, that's almost a parable or an image for what this whole story has been about. He's been entrapped by the tangledness of his family and their violence. And now here he is, vulnerable. Some man comes by and then reports to Joab, well, hey, Absalom's caught up in this tree. Joab says, what do you think you're doing? Why didn't you kill him? I would have given you a reward for killing him. I mean, he's the cause of all this trouble for my master David. The man says, hey, I heard what David said. I'm not going to do that deed. Joab goes and does it. To Joab, this is no more a crime than killing Uriah was a crime. If it serves David, and he believes it does, it needs to be done, he'll do it. That's Joab. And then the civil war is over, verses 16 to 18. Joab sounds the trumpet. Absalom's body is disposed of, not as you would dispose of the body of a prince, but just buried there in the forest. Then the word comes to David, verses 19 to 33. Now there's this young, bright guy who's the son of another cabinet-level member, and he wants to run fast and tell David the news. Joab's kind of worried about that because Joab remembers how some messengers have been treated when they bring David bad news. And so he says, no, don't you go. And he sends an unnamed black man, a Cushite, to bear the news. Well, this young, bright guy, up-and-coming administrator type guy, runs ahead and gets there to tell David, starts telling David. David comes to the point that's so important to him. He says, how about Absalom? And then the young man can't bring himself to say anything. He says, well, it was such a mess, I couldn't tell what was going on. And kind of slinks off to the side. The black man arrives. David comes to the same point. What about Absalom? And he tells the truth to David. And David's response, verse 33, the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said, oh, my son, Absalom, my son, Absalom, would I had died instead of you, oh, Absalom, my son, my son. David is here feeling that it's not what he said it was in the case of Uriah. It's not just that in a war some people die and some people are spared and you can't tell and it's all random. He knows the grief and the pain this time because he's at the receiving end of it. And calls Absalom's name 3 times and his relationship 5 times. Here at the last, we see the emotion that we wish David had shown sooner, because if he had, it might have changed the story. Why do I believe, Culbertson says, the story of David and Absalom should be classified as a text of terror for men? First, because it shows us the tragic but predictable result of our emotional dysfunction as men, a dysfunction learned in childhood and reinforced in our professional lives. With careful reading of the whole text, David can be seen to have emotions, but he appears unable to share them with Absalom. At the end of the story, he weeps, but it's too late, for both of his sons are now dead, and neither can see the human David who lay behind the professional office all along. Second, the story haunts us with the realization that our children are more like us than we want. Absalom's rebellion and cruelty appear to be nothing more than a mirror of his father's character. In addressing the story, we realize it's not enough simply to create new opportunities for our children in the hopes that they'll seize them. As long as we do not change ourselves, our children will imitate and ultimately perpetuate our most negative characteristics and paralyses. Third, as we identify with the father and king portrayed here, we get a sense of the price we must pay in order to act out the new sensitivity to which we feel called. David's choice seems to have been between nurturing justice and love within his family and turning his energies to the power of the throne. The text is frightening in that it seems to suggest that nurture and professional commitment are mutually exclusive categories, and that the perpetuation of the traditional male absorption in work, from which we've learned to draw so much of our sense of who we are, leaves the children in our families victims to illusion and violence. In his book, Finding Our Fathers, The Unfinished Business of Manhood, Samuel Osherson writes, "The search to identify what it means to be a male nurturer, to be a father who cares and protects in a fuller, more engaged way than just by imitating a John Wayne tough, you could say a King David tough guy soldier, or a businessman breadwinner, is the serious quest that underlies the at times seemingly comic male the seemingly comic male self-explorations of our times. How to be strong and caring, those are themes that men are struggling with. Sitting at lunch with a former Harvard administrator who's just turned 40, I hear about his recent weekend at a men's retreat north of San Francisco. Of all the activities of those days, one incident stands out for him. One of the exercises we did, he said, was based on those American Indian initiation ceremonies where the brave has to run a gauntlet composed of all the men of the tribe. The entire group of 50 men lined up in a gauntlet, and each person ran down it holding a doll, an infant. The doll was to give us a purpose. We were to shelter it from the blows as we ran, enfolding the vulnerable with male strength. I believe men want to do this, Culbertson says, but we don't know how. Christian tradition has given us a distant fatherly God whose nurturing side is rarely acknowledged. Traditional sex role stereotyping offers virtually no models for enfolding the vulnerable with male strength. There is as yet no real community of men in which we can learn what it means to nurture each other or to nurture a son or a daughter or a wife. Such communities are only beginning to develop, and while they've begun to address issues of male peer bonding, thus far they've not addressed well the relationship between father and son. As long as we don't know how to shape nurturing relationships one-to-one, we cannot know how to live in a nurturing community. Yet from its beginning, the church has understood itself as a community of faith. What does the word community mean for those who don't know how to nurture relationships? If we're already too isolated from other men, a personal faith is of little hope for offering new sensitivities to God's presence in community. How can we understand a God who dwells among us if there is no us among whom to dwell? How can we understand a God of both a loving justice and a forgiving mercy when we've been taught by our role heritage to opt instead for authoritarianism and isolationism within our own families? The voice of King David in this story, and then likewise the voice of his son Absalom, and Amnon and all, and Solomon, we're going to see that too, the voice of David's son, are voices that speak, and the voices of the people David surrounds himself with, Joab, are voices that speak of power to put someone on top of someone else. The vision had been that David would be one of the lambs who would protect the marginalized and the needy, but instead that doesn't happen. And yet within the stories we looked at today, I do hear another voice. It's not the voice spoken by the men in the stories, it's the voice spoken by the women in the story, although they're marginal characters. One of the women is Tamar, the raped daughter and sister. In 2 Samuel 13, Tamar is the voice that says no to violence. In the presence of her brother, the rapist, she doesn't panic. She says, no, my brother. She doesn't renounce the relationship with him. But she says, do not violate me. Do not hurt yourself. She tells what the consequences will be. Where would I carry my shame? You'd be like a foolish one in Israel. She gives an alternative. Speak to the king. He won't keep me from you. If you want to do this thing, do it in the publicly acceptable, structured way. And even after he raped her, she said, no, now what you're doing, sending me away, is a greater evil than the other thing you've already done to me. Tamar's is the voice that says, no, the violence has got to stop. And then we've got that wise woman of Tekoa who suggests to David an alternative way he could have ordered his family. He saw the vision for a minute. He didn't go through with it. But she told him, she was a wise one. She was able to discern and articulate and practice life outside of the military categories, outside of the royal privilege categories. And the scenario that she had was that he could have reorganized his family life around the forgiveness of sin. He could have called Absalom back and forgiven him for revenge. He could have called Absalom back and kissed him with real reconciliation instead of with merely public show. She showed him, or suggested to him, that instead of rage and resentment and pride, real virtue could have been shown not in keeping the grudge alive, but in bringing the banished son home. And David almost bought it. And then in chapter 20, just after the passages we've looked at, here's the situation. David is the king. Absalom's challenge has been banished. But he's a shaky king, and it looks like the northern tribes, want to secede from the union. There's a separatist movement being led by Sheba, who's a member of the tribe of Benjamin, which had supported Saul. So Joab is going to lay siege to the city of Abel, where this separationist Sheba has holed up. Verse 16. Then a wise woman called from the city, hear, listen, pay attention. It's like, hear, O Israel, the beginning of the commandments. Tell Joab, come here that I may speak to you. And Joab, this quintessential representative of the military government and of David's kind of machismo rule, comes. The woman says, are you Joab? He answered, I am. Then she said to him, listen to the words of your maidservant. And he answered, I am listening. Then she said, they were wont to say in olden times, let them but ask counsel at Abel. And so they settled a matter. In other words, this is a town with a history of peaceably solving disputes, of dispensing justice. I am one of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city which is a mother in Israel. Why will you swallow up the heritage of the Lord? She could have put it more clearly to Joab. Joab and the might of David's monarchy have come with arms to destroy. She speaks as a voice peaceable and faithful, a mothering voice for this mothering city. She says, there's another way to do this. We can talk. We can treasure peace. We can live on the basis of trust. You don't need to destroy the whole city to get what you want. What do you want? She says. Joab says, well, this guy's hiding in there. She says, fine, we'll give you this one guy. But the end does not justify the means. And so she stands as an important contrast to the relentlessness of David, the ruthlessness of Joab. She says there's more to public life. Public life can be reorganized around this heritage of peaceableness and faithfulness that God has given us. And while justice can be done, let it be done carefully so that people don't get hurt who don't need to be hurt. And her voice models another way of public life. So if David and David's successors, whom we all are, because one thing I feel in reading these stories is how much I am like David, like Saul, like Joab. If we can hear in ourselves and in our society this kind of voice as well, then maybe there is hope for us. All based on that covenant of a loving God who says, and no matter what happens, I won't withdraw my love and support from you. Thank you.